Money FM 89.3, the best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
The U.S. dollar has been on a tear this year, right? Will the U.S. dollar strength take some time to hit earnings, though? Does a stronger dollar hurt your portfolio? So as we head into earnings season, we're going to crystallize the question and ask which companies could benefit and which could not from a strong dollar. So which stocks go up and which go down when the dollar is strong? And Roy Poe reached out to me on Twitter. Yeah, you can find me there at @MichelleMartin_. You know, that little thing that looks like a hyphen but isn't because it's lower on the page. So Roy Poe wanted to understand two particular stocks in the BNPL space, Affirm and Stone. And he wants to know whether buy now, pay later, even though these stocks have been really hammered, is it a case of good value now or is it buy now, go bust later? Well, we'll find out with our very special guest, Tim Phillips, Head of Content and Investment Lead for Prosperous CGS CIMB Securities. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Michelle. How are you?
Doing really well. So help us understand the U.S. dollar because it's been compared to a wrecking ball in markets. So this epic U.S. dollar rally, outsized rally for 2022. So help us understand how strong the dollar is really.
Yeah, so I mean, currently the dollar index, which is also known as the DXY, it's at a 20-year high. So it's actually not been this high since early 2000s. And so the dollar index is basically measured against half a dozen major
currencies.
A currency basket. Yeah, I think euro's got the most weighting in that, like 57%. And then there's this yen, sterling, and a couple other European currencies. But obviously, all three of the sterling, euro, and yen have been absolutely hammered this year versus the dollar. I think, you know, there are a few things driving that. I think, firstly, it's more a case of it's the least of all the bad options, right? So I think the U.S. dollar generally tends to benefit when there is a lot of fear in markets. Mm-hmm. So it's more seen as a safe haven currency. If you look at the issues that other regions and countries around the world are facing, it just seems to be worse off than the U.S. So you've got even worse inflation in Europe, and you've also got an energy crisis brewing there with winter approaching. Winter is coming, as the Game of Thrones saying goes, and it's not going to be pretty, I think, for Europe. In China, you've got, you know, COVID zero, you've got a property overhang. And in Asia, you know, really exports are starting to slow and economies are starting to slow. But surprisingly, the Singapore dollar has actually held up quite well. But I think that's been a case of obviously a lot of money coming in, a lot of capital inflows into Singapore. So Singapore has actually held up pretty well in terms of its performance against the U.S. dollar. I think it's down around 5% year to date versus the dollar, whereas, you know, things like sterling and the euro down around 15 to 20%. So it's been a pretty bad showing for those currencies.
Yeah, and really great for some tourists. A friend's daughter of mine made her way to UK over the weekend and said, why haven't we come here? Everything's so affordable. It's fabulous. So, yes, you mentioned investors looking at the dollar as a safe haven, and that has a self-reinforcing sort of effect, right? Because when global investors pour their money into U.S. dollars, they're going to sell off other currencies. And so buying dollars pushes up the value of the greenback, and selling other currencies weakens their value.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, I think it's mainly, as you said, global capital flows, but also I think thrown into that mix is the Ukraine war and the energy crisis, right? You've seen energy prices just go through the roof. I think that's being felt by consumers and also at the macro level in terms of regions and countries. And so generally a strong dollar tends to benefit energy exporters, right? Basically countries that are exporting energy because oil, gas, all these things are priced in dollars. And so with Europe, they're an energy importer. So that's really been a headwind for Europe because they're having to import oil, gas, and that's all priced in dollars usually. So around, you know, 85 to 90% of globally traded goods are priced in dollars. So the dollar is really the reserve currency and it's really the dominant global currency. So being priced in dollars, it really impacts countries that are importing energy. And that's something that's really fed through to countries like Europe. And so it's interesting because you see countries that you would expect to have weakened significantly against the dollar, like the Brazilian real, which is obviously the currency of Brazil. Mm. And Brazil is an energy exporter, right? It has Petrobras. It has a lot of agricultural heft as well in terms of grains, in terms of beef, in terms of other natural resources. And the Brazilian real is up about sort of 7 to 8% against the dollar so far in 2022. So it's a good example of how the impact of energy and the impact of natural resources has on the performance of the dollar as well.
All right. So you mentioned they could be possible winners. We know that 40% of international revenue exposure of the S&P overall relates to the U.S. dollar. And, you know, we've heard in early reporting a lot of companies citing negative impact to their profits or their earnings or their revenues because of unfavorable foreign exchange rates. Are there any other potential winners when it comes to a stronger dollar?
I mean, I think the obvious answer to that would probably be companies rather that are generating, that are mostly domestic in the U.S. that have most of their sales coming from the domestic market, right? So I think some of the big retailers, say like Target or some of the home improvement retailers like Home Depot or Lowe's, like these guys that have a lot of their revenue that comes in U.S. dollars and they really don't have that much foreign exposure, that's going to be more of a, I guess, defensive nature. I wouldn't say it's going to be maybe so noticeable in terms of earnings growth, because I think that the macro environment right now is just so poor that I think all companies are going to have to probably guide down in this upcoming quarter for earnings. But it will provide, I guess, an element of defensiveness if you're thinking about a strong dollar, particularly when it comes to, you know, I guess the big tech companies like Apple and even Microsoft that have a lot of foreign revenue exposure, that's going to be impacting the bottom line. And we saw that already recently with Nike.
FedEx.
Nike came out with earnings. Yeah, FedEx, yeah. Nike, they came out with earnings a couple of weeks ago, and they're already starting to see the impact of the strong dollar. So I think that's yet to feed through into estimates. I think a lot of sell side research is still definitely more optimistic than I think most of the market is expecting, you know, the earnings outlook to be when it's announced in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, as you say, the full ramifications have yet to be felt because it takes time for currency fluctuations to flow through to earnings. I guess the next interesting question is, will we expect this rally to continue, this tear to continue? Will it continue to be strong? What could hold back the rise of the dollar?
I think mainly, I mean, the immediate future, unless things change, unless the picture outside the U.S. becomes markedly I guess, brighter for other countries versus the U.S. economy, I don't think anything's really going to maybe hold back, you know, that trade. I think it's probably one of the most overcrowded trades right now in the market, right? Everyone talks about going along the dollar. It's one of the most crowded trades, but there's very many good reasons for that. I think for it to change markedly, obviously, you'd have to have not to use the word pivot, because I think that's one of the most overused words from the Fed in terms of the pivot for the Fed. But I think more inflation starting to come down, the Fed maybe pausing on actual rate hikes, and the global macro picture is starting to look better outside the U.S., as I said. I think all those, maybe those two things are really key. I think the Fed thinking about pausing or not hiking as fast. And then secondly, the macro picture for economies outside of the U.S. becoming a lot more attractive versus the U.S. Because at the moment, as I said, the U.S. economy, even though it's weakening, it's a lot stronger and it looks a lot better than the alternatives outside of the U.S.
All right. So we mentioned when it comes to losers, it's likely MNCs and U.S. exporters. Do you also see the stronger dollar continuing to strain countries that have debt denominated in dollars, so emerging economies? And are we seeing investors at all invest their portfolios with this in mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting point this time is that, you know, I think about in 2012 when there was that taper tantrum and, you know, there was the Fragile Five, I think Indonesia and India were among those countries that were included in that basket. But I think this time around, a lot of Asian emerging markets at least have been better prepared, and current account deficits are not as high as before. So a lot of countries have kind of, I guess, foreseen the rise of rates, and they've been pretty conservative. You're seeing obviously problems in pockets like Turkey, for example, which has seen the Turkish lira just being absolutely hammered, and then higher inflation. But that has to do with, I think, central banking policy as well in Turkey, which is continuing to be really loose. I think in terms of markets, I mean, if you're thinking about Japan, some people are touting Japan as a really interesting market now because obviously the yen is super weak, but a lot of companies listed there have obviously massive export markets, right? And they export a lot. So they're going to be much more competitive in this environment. But the yen has been particularly weak. And so I think unless you're starting to see inflation pick up there a little bit, but unless the Bank of Japan starts to tighten considerably, I think it's still going to be a headwind for countries such as Japan.
So Roy Paul reached out to me on Twitter with a request. He wants to understand two stocks and how they're performing now. Affirm was on his list. They're one of the largest BNPL companies in the U.S., and they offer plans that enable companies to divide the costs over time for purchases, both big and small. And if you look at Affirm, the company's price to sales has contracted about 82% since the beginning of the year. Its share price has plunged 89% from its 52-week high. Some say there's a possibility for its valuation to drop further with weak market sentiment and this risk-off trade conditions. On the flip side, we have another BNPL company that has caught Roy's eye. It's called Stone Company, which is down over 90% from its all-time high last year. It's a Warren Buffett-backed fintech and offers financial tech services to merchants and consumers across Brazil. So, like Affirm, will Stone Co. sink like a stone or rebound? Let's find out what Tim Phillips has to say. Tim, how do you think these two companies will perform in a recessionary environment?
Let me start with Affirm, right? It's important to note that Affirm is really just a proxy for consumer sentiment, right? Because effectively, how I see Affirm is, as you just noted, right, it's buy now, pay later. So it's basically slicing and dicing a transaction and allowing the consumer to purchase it either in, you know, installments of four every quarter or every year. And so it lengthens out the time horizon and it slices the loan up, or it slices the transaction size up, right? And so Affirm claims to, or says it has proprietary data and risk models in terms of how it analyzes users and its loan delinquency rates and et cetera, et cetera. But I think the main issue for Affirm is that its whole business model is tied to the U.S. consumer economy, right, which at the moment is not looking so good. And so a lot of the purchases that are made through Affirm are made, obviously, they're discretionary items, so consumer discretionary items that are probably going to be the first things that consumers are going to cut out if they start tightening their belts, right? And you're starting to see that. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the consumer being really, you know, flush with cash, et cetera, in the U.S., and that's fine. It's sitting a lot of stimulus money, but I think that's run out, you know, that's long past its sell-by date in terms of that thesis. I think what you're starting to see, and it's starting to come through in the data, is that credit card debt is starting to rise. You know, credit card balances in the second quarter of this year rose at its fastest percentage increase in over 20 years, right? So credit card debt now, or credit card balances in the U.S., have hit about close to $890 billion. And so what that means is that that's first off what's owed on credit cards, but that's also interest owed on credit cards, right? So you're starting to see the U.S. consumer be, I guess, extended and sort of stretched by inflation. First off, I think one of the reasons there's been worries in the market is that wage growth also hasn't kept up with inflation. So even though wage growth is around 5%, inflation or CPI is running at around 8-9%, right? So real wage growth is actually negative. So the consumer is starting to feel that pinch in the U.S. And I think that's really affected the thesis, at least in the short term or the immediate term, for something like Affirm. And I think you've kind of seen that play out in other consumer discretionary names. It's just, I think it's amplified because Affirm is a tech firm with, as you had said, a pretty inflated price to sales ratio, and it's down around 90%, right? So in terms of the business itself, how can it come out of this? I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I don't know about you, but Michelle, but when I see BNPL, I mean, wasn't that around like a decade ago? I mean, I remember going into, like, I don't know, I'm from Hong Kong, so I went into an electronics store when I was maybe in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. I bought a TV. It was like my first big purchase, and they allowed me to do it in installments, right? With a credit card. So I'm just kind of baffled as to how this is any different. I think the case has been made that this is so different, right? In the heyday, it was like, this is, you know, they know what's happening. This is, that their loan delinquency rates are really low. And I think this is going to start to blow up, this thesis, in the next sort of like 6 months as loan delinquency rates rise. and the consumer starts to get strained even more, right? Because in terms of who uses BNPL, if you have enough money or if you have enough liquidity and you're, I guess, affluent enough, there's really no reason for you to use it, right? Mm-mm. So the demographics that are using it, I mean, the largest demographic that uses Affirm is in the 25 to 34-year-old range, right? And so that's a younger demographic. It's probably a demographic that is not at its height of its earnings power. It's probably ones that are more comfortable taking on debt. But in terms of how that's going to play out when the picture turns in the macro sense, that's still yet to be defined, right? And so I think for something like Affirm, they're more of a one-trick pony. That's all they do. They just focus on BNPL. Mm. If you think about stuff like, I guess, Square and now known as Block and PayPal, I mean, they've been hit pretty hard this year as well, but they're nowhere near as badly down as Affirm. Mm. And so Affirm has come down, 90%, as you said, from the high. It's got a very strong relationship with big consumer names, brands like Amazon and Shopify and a few other channels. So the partnerships are really solid. Mm. But in terms of it seems to me more of like a takeout target for a big fintech to add on, right? A bolt-on acquisition, because in terms of its market cap, it's come down significantly. It's focused on this one area. It's not really thinking about remittances or other areas. So I think it's more a case of, is this something that maybe a PayPal would look at as an interesting acquisition, or maybe a bigger fintech would look at as an interesting bolt-on acquisition to beef up? Obviously not Block, because they paid, what was it, $17 billion at the height for Afterpay. But I think they're going to be a difficult picture, and I think they will suffer considerably in a recessionary environment.
Right. When times are good and credit is cheap, then, you know, this business model will work. But we're also seeing banks aping this very model, right? Apple also entering this sector. Yeah.
Yeah. I think DBS is doing it. I feel like every bank is kind of doing their own BNPL, because it's probably so easy to build on the back end, right?
Yeah.
You just extend it out and be like, I've got an incentive. I think I did something on the BNPL because they gave me extra miles, right? And I had it was a no lose situation. It was 0% interest. And I was like, okay, I guess if you're going to give me an incentive and free miles or points, I would do that. But unless you're going to give me free things to do it, I wouldn't really be that bothered about doing that, because it's more like taking on more than you can afford. And you're kind of seeing that with, as I said, in the U.S. consumer market, the consumer is being stretched. And so the first things they're going to cut are, spend on electronics, spend on fashion, spend on maybe travel, other things, which is, surprise, surprise, it's the biggest revenue sources for things like Affirm, because they're extending these loans. And you've kind of seen loan provisions hit. It was up 290% year on year for loan provisions from Affirm in its latest earnings report. And the loan delinquency rate is also up significantly. So I think we're at the start of this playing out. And so I think in terms of the picture for Affirm, I think it could get worse in the short term.
If we look at its 52-week high, $176, and its current share price, $19, there could be an even better entry point in the future, you think?
I think so, and I would say I'm not so sure. From a short-term play, maybe it would be. I'm thinking longer term. Would it perhaps be taken over, or would there be a bid for it? And I think that is more of a danger for investors who have maybe bought at higher prices. So it's more of a case of, where do you see this business in sort of like 5 years' time, 10 years' time, right? And is it so unique that other companies aren't going to ape it? And I think the answer to that is no, because you've seen a lot of competitors come in and pretty much do the same thing, at least in the US. And in Asia, you're seeing the same thing, right? We have DBS doing it. We have Atome doing BNPL as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm not an expert on those areas, but I just don't really see any differentiation between them. I mean, they extend credit. They give you the terms. You can pay in installments. Okay, that's great. Well, what's the USP, right, for these brands? I mean, they have partnerships. If they have exclusive partnerships, that adds more of a moat. But beyond that, I don't really see a massive moat there for companies like Affirm. As for StoneCo,
is it slightly different, do you think?
Yeah. I think StoneCo is a slightly different proposition. I mean, because StoneCo is focused on an emerging market, its main business is actually solely focused on Brazil, right?
Right.
So it's done quite well in terms of, I guess, having a bit more diversification. it has its financing, the finance, like fintech side, and it also has the software side. So it's a bit more of a storefront type of backend processing for, you know, for invoices and things like that for small and medium-sized businesses. And so I think there's a bit more diversification there. And if you look at the earnings, the revenue growth, it's held up pretty well this year for StoneCo, whereas for Affirm, you know, in 2 quarters ago, it was hitting 77% growth year on year in terms of revenue. And in its latest quarter, it was 39%. So for Affirm, revenue growth has kind of dropped off and it seems to have plateaued in terms of revenue itself. Whereas StoneCo is a bit more diversified in terms of revenue streams. It has dropped off considerably, as you said, again, but I think that's more a fact, but more to do with the fact that, you know, it was highly valued and growth stocks just across the board have been absolutely hammered. If you look at the macro picture of Brazil, it's actually relatively okay. I mean, as I said, alluded to earlier, the real's up against the dollar, so it's actually been pretty positive for the macro picture there. And the economy is expected to grow around 3-4% this year. So that's not bad in terms of, I guess, the global picture, right? The Brazilian economy. I think if Brazil goes into recession, then obviously that tends to be a bit different because, as we know, small and medium-sized businesses tend to get hit pretty hard rather than large multinationals. And StoneCo's sort of the payments and the client base is really tied to small and medium-sized businesses that use its services. But I think in the current environment, it seems to have more of a defensive moat than say Affirm does.
Okay, so the share price of StoneCo has gained momentum recently. I think it was up 10.8% recently, well ahead of the S&P 500's increase, 3%. Yeah. And really, it came to prominence after Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway disclosed that it has about 10.7 million StoneCo shares. I guess the question is, could the company be poised for a breakout? It did report quite impressive financial results June 2nd, profitability appearing to rebound, but it's still battling those bad loans that it took in 2021, and of course, a bad Brazilian economy.
I mean, Berkshire Hathaway is synonymous with Warren Buffett, right? But I think we should be clear that a lot of the tech investments nowadays are being made by, you know, Todd Koons, one of his lieutenants, who's CEO of Geico, right? So I think Warren Buffett is not someone who, you know, who went out and bought Snowflake, for example. I mean, there was an interview with the Snowflake CEO, Frank Slootman, and I think he talked about the fact that he spoke to Todd Koons about 90% of the time when he was talking about Berkshire investing in Snowflake. So I think for these types of tech investments, it's done by Berkshire, but it's not carried out by Warren Buffett personally, which is fine. And I think for the team at Berkshire, I think they obviously saw a lot of potential in Brazil. They've seen what Mercado Libre has done, obviously, with e-commerce platform and then moving into payments. I think there's a lot of potential there. I think in terms of the short-term rebound recently, that's been a bit more focused on the election because Brazil, if you know listeners aren't aware, is going through a presidential election. And there's the right-wing Bolsonaro, who's the incumbent. He is facing off against Lula, who's the left-wing ex-president. And so I think because it's gone off into a runoff, I think the market is more bullish, let's say, on the right wing, on Bolsonaro, just because he appeared to be more market friendly. And I think he did better than expected in the first round runoff versus Lula. So I think it's going to be a close second round, which is happening at the end of this month on 30th or 31st of October. So I think watch out for the results from the election there, because in terms of the share price for things like StoneCo and Mercado Libre, that could move share prices in the short term.
Wow. Fascinating. Terrific insight, Tim. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Michelle. It's great to be on.
Does a stronger dollar hurt your portfolio? And as we head into earnings season, which stocks could go up and which go down when the dollar is strong? Which companies could we see benefiting and which could not from a stronger dollar? That's what we discuss with Tim Phillips, Head of Content and Investment Lead for Prosperous, CGS CIMB Securities. And you just heard him there rounding off a great discussion that originated from a listener question. Roy Poe, thank you so much for sending your question in. And my thanks also to Young Money Managers founder Deepa Kishnani for invaluable research, helping us all understand Stone and Affirm. Once again, that was the amazing Tim Phillips, Head of Content and Investment Lead for Prosperous, CGS CIMB Securities, joining me live on Money and Me. I'm Michelle Martin.
Before acting on the information on Money FM,
Please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.